What is the National Theater of the Deaf?
The National Theater of the Deaf is a company of 11 actors and 4 technicians. 8 of the actors are deaf. 3 are hearing. I am one of the hearing actors. As we call ourselves, walkie-talkies, because we speak the written script that you are seeing in sign language. So you don't go and watch a silent pantomime. We are not a pantomime company.
David Fitzsimmons is one of the 3 speaking actors in the company, who performed in Alaska recently, giving performances in Fairbanks and Anchorage. The play was an adaptation of the tale of Pinocchio, titled The Wooden Boy or The Secret Life of Geppetto's Dummy. It was not for children, and it was unlike most dramatic productions. There were, not too surprisingly, lots of silences. Time seemed to take on a different dimension. The play was a kind of time warp, with characters who signed while other actors spoke for them. The speaking actors were sometimes called upon to voice for 2 other roles, plus their own, all within the same scene. And they also signed for themselves as well, but not always.
It goes both ways. You see, we're not locked into any rule. There have been shows in The Wooden Boy. There's a scene where I speak, but another character signs for me.
Now, is it difficult when you have gestures to make? You're signing with your hands.
Uh-huh.
So that does that limit, then, some of your expression with your hands?
No, it doesn't limit it. It doesn't limit it at all. If you look at it that way, it can be a limit. When I first came into the company 2 years ago, it felt like a limit because it was so new to me, and it was somewhat frightening. You know, a whole new language. No, a whole new language is not frightening, but taking that language on stage when you don't feel that confident with it, that was a bit scary. But I'm much more comfortable with it now, and I don't see it as limiting at all. I see it as a whole another challenge, a whole different level to take that gesture into.
Is it like a new form of theater?
It is a different form of theater, completely.
The National Theater of the Deaf was founded 12 years ago by Broadway stage designer David Hayes. The idea evolved as a result of working on a Broadway production of The Miracle Worker. Hayes and a group of co-workers visited Gallaudet College in Washington, D.C., a liberal arts college for the deaf. While there, they attended a theatrical performance, and the group was, as David Fitzsimmons tells it, captivated by the idea.
The actors and the directors who had gone down were able to see this and became quite caught up with the idea of new theater. This is a wonderful idea. They're performing in a different language, and it's a visual language. It's not like listening to an Italian opera. Something completely different.
Sometime later, David Hayes saw the idea of a full-fledged deaf theater company become reality. The company has now performed in all states except Nevada, this was the first trip to Alaska, Europe, Asia, and Australia, and has appeared in films and on television. Though the group's home base is the Eugene O'Neill Memorial Theater Center in Waterford, Connecticut, with such an extensive touring schedule, the theater manages to spend little time there, though there is a summer school workshop held annually for company members and would-be members. Fitzsimmons became a member of the company partially through his training in sign language, and he first saw the group while he was learning to sign.
Yeah, I was in a sign language class, and in that class, somebody said, the teacher said he can get us tickets for the National Theater of the Deaf, and the idea of it was quite intriguing. So I did go, and they did an opera, and I was totally amazed. I said, this is not possible, and they did it, and it was wonderful.
Bob Vaughn, executive director for the Alaska Association for the Arts in Fairbanks, worked for over a year to bring the Theater of the Deaf to Alaska. He tried various airline schemes and eventually worked Alaska into the troupe's touring schedule. The costs of the contract were split with Anchorage, which has the largest deaf community in the state. But it wasn't the deaf audience Vaughn was primarily concerned with, but rather the entire theater-going community.
Fairbanks does not have a great number of persons with substantial hearing impairments. Anchorage is much larger. But the majority of the enthusiasm in town is not from that segment of the population, but from persons who have experienced a program, seen a show outside or watched it on television and recognized it for what it is, and that is the art of theater in one of the highest forms possible.
The form of theater offered by the Theater of the Deaf is not the type that lets the audience get a snack from the fridge during a commercial break. The production of The Wooden Boy demanded attention. One had to watch constantly as the set would be transformed, as actors would sign while others spoke, and the production itself was rather abstract. Without knowing the story of Pinocchio, the action would have been even more difficult to follow. As one member of the audience put it after the production, it was something like a Fellini film. Actor Fitzsimmons acknowledges that there's work for both the company and the audience at a Theater of the Deaf performance.
I guess it's like, it's kind of like asking somebody to go on the floor and dance with you when you really don't want to dance with them. You're better off not to ask them. And it's like, we're asking the audience to dance with us for a minute. And we can do it. Any company can. Ours does it in a different way. Because we challenge the audience and we ask them to perk up, pay attention, and start using their eyes and see how much there is to see. And there is a language there. There's a definite language.
Although I was entranced by the production, it was a language that many members of the Fairbanks audience found incomprehensible, even boring. The pace tended to be slow, the action sometimes difficult to follow, there were characters whose function was hard to grasp, and occasionally there was a bit of gratuitous action. The pregnant woman, a speaking actor, who repeated the action of holding out her hand and asking for money for her babies. The front of her dress was stuffed with a slipping pillow. The action was meant to be funny, but got tiresome. Perhaps this adaptation of a children's story was less than successful, but it is one of the few plays actually written for the company. The process of taking a script and adapting it to their particular mode of theater is different than for a company with all speaking actors.
Is a script actually written out for your company as it is for any other company, and then people sign those lines in effect? How does that work?
Okay. With a script like The Wooden Boy, that is more specifically written like a company piece. There's a difference. Because the speaking and the signing was both written by us. And it happened simultaneously. And much of the speaking changed because of the way the signing went. Now, with a different script written by someone else, we have to be true to their words. We have to be true to their script. So that often ends up being like two simultaneous scripts. You have a signed script, but it's basically the words. And see, you can't write sign. You really can't write it down. But the deaf actors will have a written script. And then I guess the unwritten script is an unwritten script.
There are signs that are untranslatable into verbal speech, but the company fiercely adheres to the policy of not producing plays specifically for the deaf, but of combining speech and sign and mime and anything that works to communicate their special brand of theater to an audience. Although there is a small company within the company that does produce plays in sign language, they are a theater for the deaf rather than of the deaf, an important distinction in a group that seeks to communicate to all audiences. Though there are many applicants from deaf actors for positions in the summer school, there are extremely few deaf directors or playwrights for now, although there is a deaf playwrights workshop conducted simultaneously with the acting school.
An important thing to remember is, right now, the deaf situation, in terms of theater experiences, this is all very new. Well, it's over 10 years, but that's still relatively young. It's very easy for a hearing person to get theater experience. It's not quite as easy for a deaf person. Not yet.
David Fitzsimmons, a walkie-talkie, one of the speaking members of the National Theater of the Deaf. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. There's a gas station outside, graffiti in the entranceway, a large red and white Texaco sign inside, an engine block sitting on a counter, pistons lying around the tables, hubcaps, license plates, and lots of gear lube cans. You can buy antifreeze, lubes, spare parts, high-performance specials, and even noisy mufflers. Sounds like a filling station, right? It is, but not the kind where you buy gas for your car. Instead, it's a place to get fuel in the form of food. It's the Filling Station Restaurant in Fairbanks. Located south of town among new and used car dealerships and auto repair shops, the place looks right at home.
I took off on a weekend last month just to try to recall the whole year. All of the places and all of the faces, now wondering where they all disappear.
The music is performed by co-owner Ron Shepard, who runs the restaurant with wife-to-be Laura Sturdivant. She does the cooking and baking. But unlike other filling stations, there are no additives, just good home cooking. I asked Laura how they'd gotten the idea for a restaurant with the ambience of a gas station.
We were just looking through some cookbooks, and we saw that fast food and good service is usually called filling station, and we thought that was a pretty cute idea.
The engine block that holds the silverware, many of the license plates that decorate the walls, the lube cans that serve as seats, and the pistons that serve as ashtrays were donated by local businesses. It's a recyclable internal combustion decor. Apparently, customers have no problem with associations of gas stations being greasy, unappetizing places and attaching that association to the restaurant.
We haven't got any association whatsoever with a gas station, although we've been asked a couple of times, was this a gas station before? No, we just wanted to have a fun place and kind of a different place and a place that people would feel at home here. And most people that come here are working people or working men. They want hot food and big large sandwiches and good prices, and that's what we felt like we could offer them. Good home-cooked food that we don't have anything that's frozen or anything that comes from a can. Everything's made from scratch.
Everything except the pickles at the filling station is made from scratch. The apple crunch pie is made with fresh apples. The ice cream comes from the White Mountain ice cream freezer that cranks away. The meat is purchased fresh daily, and the barbecue beef marinates overnight in a sauce that Laura makes. Corners aren't cut here. One of Laura's specialties is chili, listed on the menu under noisy mufflers.
For eating hot chili, it's not silly to eat hot chili.
I'm from Texas, so I know how to make chili.
Could you give us your chili recipe?
Sure, if you'd like to have it, yeah, no problem. Chili basically is made with, we kind of vary it because when we first started making it, people said it wasn't spicy enough. So now we put about 2 cups of chili powder in instead of a cup. And then we put red pepper, and we use a good chunky chili meat, and we use kidney beans and pinto beans.
Besides the chili, the filling station offers other specialties of the station, grouped on the menu under headings that you'd expect to find in the other kind of filling station. Ron explains.
Well, the drinks come under lubricants, and then we have bowls of beans with cornbread, nachos, and a cup of chili listed under noisy mufflers. High-performance specials are, of course, our non-dietary substance on our menu, our pastry and ice cream. We make our own ice cream right here, too, from scratch. We make up our own base, and we can make 5 gallons at a time. And it seems like during the winter time here, even the ice cream is going as fast as we can make it. This is the sound of the machine working. It's not very loud, and the customers really enjoy it.
The gas station theme even extends to the ice cream. Instead of using ice and salt to pack around the cylinder to get the mixture to set up, Ron uses antifreeze. Even the health inspector approved. For now, they're just making vanilla, but hope to expand the offerings. Peppermint will be coming up in time for Christmas. The ice cream is often served with another high-performance special, home-baked pies.
For me, oh my, love their country pie. Raspberry, strawberry, lemon, and lime. What do I care?
Pies are another of Laura's imported from Texas specials. She makes a crust with milk and honey. The apples for the apple crunch pie is marinated in sugar and cinnamon, and the topping is a brown sugar, honey, and pecans, plus some other stuff that all together makes for a real stomach tune-up, one of the favorites of the clientele and the owners. Besides the food and the unusual ambience, which includes bathrooms labeled pistons and cylinders for men and women respectively, music is also available, either from the jukebox or courtesy of Ron himself, who was playing when I came in the other evening, sitting on a stool on a stage that was propped up on empty lube cans and with an enormous Texaco sign as a backdrop.
Yeah, we're trying to get all the local musicians down here that would like to come in, and we're trying to start up some jam sessions on Sundays and to where we can build up a night clientele to be able to afford to support some of the local musicians, because we do have a lot of local talent here in Alaska, and it's kind of a shame that people have to hire other bands that are out of state when we have so much talent right here.
The restaurant has been open for 2 weeks now, 7 days a week, making the filling station Ron and Laura's first home, given the heavy baking, cooking, and ice cream making schedule, plus brainstorming time for those crazy ideas. That includes the graffiti room as you enter or leave the restaurant. It's as much fun as the rest of the place, from the 1910 red and white gas pump outside the door to the urinal in the woman's room with a cactus growing inside. One of the graffitos states, the filling station is a real gas. Another says, the only place in town where you pay for your food and get your gas for free. That person must have eaten a noisy muffler. For the owners, running the filling station is also a gas.
Providing people with something that they enjoy doing, because I don't know very many people that don't enjoy eating good food, and they providing us with of enjoying our food and our place has meant more to me than anything.
These changes in latitude, changes in attitude, nothing remains quite the same. All of my running and all of my gunning, if I could nap, I just would go insane. We couldn't nap, we just would go insane. We were not crazy, we would go insane.
Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. What's the first thing you do when you get up in the morning?
The first thing I do when I get up in the morning is put the coffee on.
Do you have to light a fire or anything to do that?
No, but I do light a fire in our wood stove.
After you get the coffee going?
After I get the coffee going. First things, priorities.
I take a shower when I first get up in the morning. That's the first thing I do.
First thing I do when I get up in the morning is get dressed.
Right away?
First thing, it's cold in my house.
And then what do you have to get clothes on?
Go to the bathroom.
Is that outside or inside?
Outside.
Write my dreams down.
You dream a lot?
Yes, I dream a lot, and I always write them down. And a lot of times I can't read it when I go back to rewrite them. But I struggle over to the... I roll over, and I, before I get my eyes open, grab my pencil. Otherwise, I won't remember my dreams.
Stretch.
Make coffee.
Look around, I guess.
And then what?
I'll make myself get up.
I'd rather not say.
What do you do after that?
Put my clothes on.
I turn off my electric blanket.
And then what?
I take my vitamins.
Without water or with?
Always without.
And then after you've taken your vitamins, what do you do?
I drink a glass of hot water and honey.
And then what?
Then I open my stove.
Why do you have to open your stove?
So that it gets hot.
Well, what is your stove heated with?
Coal.
Do you heat your water for your hot water on that coal fire?
No. No, I always drink my water cold.
No, you said you had hot water.
I lied.
Karen McPherson, wondering how I'm going to get up tomorrow morning in Fairbanks. The October 2nd municipal election is finally over. First, there was the election, then the highly emotional runoff for Borough Assembly Seat A, and finally a recount. The results of the runoff had put challenger Andy Corella ahead of incumbent Kevin Herron by a substantial margin, until the absentee and question ballots were counted, reversing the results. Corella, at the November 8th Borough Assembly meeting, requested a recount. After all, he had left his own seat to challenge a man he had publicly proclaimed a menace, and he had hoped for a turnaround in the results. Instead, Herron increased his lead in the recount completed this morning. Deputy Borough Clerk Gay Patrick gives the results.
Kevin Herron came out 71 votes ahead with a total of 3,074. Andy Corella, 3,003.
Okay, so we picked up 15 votes.
Right.
Who pays for this recount now?
Mr. Corella will.
And how much will that probably cost him?
About $160.
The recount started yesterday. Herron was there for only a short time, but Corella watched all day, and neither man was present at the completion of the recount this morning. While he was in attendance, Corella didn't have much to say, according to Patrick.
What did Corella's sentiment seem to be as the recount kept on going?
He didn't say much.
Was his expression saying a lot for him?
Yes.
As in negative?
Right.
The borough had no established procedures for recounts and had decided at the November 8th meeting, when Corella had requested the recount, that if the outcome of the election was changed and Corella the final victor, the borough would pick up the tab. But if the results were unchanged, it would be Corella who paid. And that's the case today. It won't be until the week following Thanksgiving, at the Borough Assembly meeting of November 29th, nearly 2 months after this whole thing started, that Herron finally gets sworn in and the chance to savor his victory. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Although the debate between Fairbanks Representative Dick Randolph and Governor Jay Hammond is off, although it apparently was never on, the controversy over reduction or elimination of the state income tax is likely to continue. Randolph has been stumping the state, drumming up support for his income tax initiative, an initiative that calls for a 1% limit on state personal income taxes. He hopes to place the initiative on the 1980 general election ballot, and at the least expects the drive and his efforts will pressure the legislature into passing a law eliminating or at least reducing the state income tax. A longtime proponent of, quote, reducing the size of government and getting the taxpayers' money to them wherever possible, Randolph's efforts on the initiative began last February.
Last February, I hired, with private funds, an attorney to explore the possibility of, every possibility of the best way to have a broad-based, across-the-board tax reduction for the Alaskan taxpayers, and to do it in such a way that would be as constitutional as possible. And, the initial reasons were twofold. One, to since the state government's grown 1,000% in the last 11 or 12 years, we feel that it's grown all out of proportion to what it should have, and that the only way you're going to prohibit or curtail that growth is to take away the money. Secondarily, we feel that since the state has ample funds at this point, that the taxpayers ought not to have to continue to pay taxes. The only legitimate reason for a government to tax is to provide the necessary services. If they have adequate money to do that, then there's no reason for them to continue to tax. And the initiative would put about $125 million back in the pockets of the people. If we can outright repeal it next session, it would put about $150 million back in the pockets of the people every year.
What do you think your chances are of passage?
Of the initiative or, mm-hmm. or a bill?
Well, first the initiative, then the bill.
I think the chance of the bill pass or the initiative passing is absolutely excellent. I don't think there's any question about it. We get the signatures and get on the ballot. I'm sure the people will vote resoundingly to repeal or to reduce the state income tax to 1%. It is our goal at this point to have enough support for the initiative by January 14th when the legislature reconvenes that every legislator will know that the one thing people want above it all else early next session is an outright repeal of the state income tax.
If you reduce or eliminate state income taxes by the reduction that you're proposing, isn't that beneficial more to people that are making a high income than to people with a low income?
I would agree. What it does for a change, it gives producers back what they've been producing. And there are those, including the governor included, who say that that's inequitable, that we're distributing oil wealth and that wealth ought to be distributed equally. It's not being distributed equally now. There are literally tens of thousands of Alaskans who are getting many, many state services that are paying nothing for those services and never have. That's a very inequitable situation. And while our state budget's been going up 1,000% in the last 11 years, the taxpayers have been paying and paying and paying and receiving some of the benefits, but there are many, many people out there who receive a lot of benefits and pay nothing.
One of the things you mentioned is a reduction in revenues to the state since the state, as you see it, doesn't need any more revenues.
Mm-hmm.
That will reduce some services.
As a practical matter, if you take $100 million away from the state government, they are going to reduce services. Mm-hmm. I have no problem with that. There are many things the government's doing that it shouldn't be doing.
Do you see this as your equivalent of California's Proposition 13?
I think it has the same, this exactly the same characteristics, and I think exactly the same thing will happen. As did in California. You put $125 to $150 million every year back into the private economy, and people will start, you know, buying things, doing things, and put the private economy will be spurred on substantially, and the state government will end up with much less of a hurt than they think they're going to have.
So the bill gets passed. Okay, we'll say it gets to that point and it's passed, and for some reason the oil production stops. There are no more excess revenues. Do you see a possibility of then going back to the public and saying, hey, let's tax again?
Sure. I think, the public should be the barometer. And I think if the state gets in a position where they can't provide the services that the public really want, the public will be willing to pay for those services.
Whether services will be reduced as a result of an elimination or reduction of the state income tax remains to be seen. After the issue of a Randolph-type repeal, a Hammond-type energy credit plan, or yet another alternative for seeking a method to return Alaska's oil revenues to residents is resolved. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Six Fairbanks women have been selected for inclusion in the 1979 edition of Outstanding Young Women of America. Only they don't officially know it yet. Their mothers do, and so does the local newspaper, and if it weren't for those two sources, the six might still not know that they were outstanding. The women are now under consideration for Outstanding Young Woman of Alaska, and ultimately one of the 10 Outstanding Young Women of America, who are between the ages of 21 and 36, and have distinguished themselves in home, career, and community. The six lucky locals are Mim Dixon, Suzanne Uticello, Kit Jensen, Rhonda Lee McCartan, Pat Monahan, and Carla Slaughter. Several have been active in women's rights organizations. One is an anthropologist, one a writer and teacher, and another heads the local public FM radio station. There's clearly a lot of potential for outstandingness right there, but the meaningfulness of the award is another matter. At least two of the six selected seemed rather nonplussed by the whole thing. Here's how writer Pat Monahan found out that she'd received an award.
I came home one night and my phone machine had a message that was rather abrupt. I had had my phone machine installed without telling my mother, and she had called from Anchorage to say, congratulations. And she got my recorded voice and abruptly said, call your mother. And so I got home, and that was all I got, call your mother. So I thought for sure something had happened and somebody was dead or my grandfather had died or something like that. So I called back, and she said, oh, I just called to congratulate you about that award. And I had no idea what award this was. And pressing her for details, I found out that it had been in the paper in Anchorage that I had been chosen an outstanding young woman. But I have not yet been notified.
Kit Jensen, station manager of KUAC-FM, also found out about the award through her parents. How is it that you came to be an outstanding young woman of Alaska?
Well, I'm not really sure. I had never heard of the Outstanding Young Women of America organization before. They sent me a letter a few months ago saying that I had been nominated and asked me to provide some basic information about myself, which I did, so I sent it into the organization. And then a few weeks ago, my parents were notified that I had been accepted, but I still have not been officially informed by the organization.
Although Jensen admitted that she liked receiving praise for her work and would like to be recognized as an Alaskan who's made contributions, when asked if she feels outstanding, she replied,
no, not at all. I feel very typical.
Pat Monahan had a different response.
What is it that you think makes you outstanding?
Beauty and intelligence. I suppose, frankly, knowing someone who's already been an outstanding young woman, it was probably what tipped the scale. I have no idea what the grounds for selection were at all. My mother did say something about a book with our names printed in it that they had the possibility of buying for a certain fee. I didn't get all of the details. And I suspect that may be the ultimate reason for the program. I think my mother got a letter in the mail announcing to her that I had been elected, which all of which makes me think that this is a good reason to make mothers buy books with daughters' names and not much else.
Overall, what impact will this have on your life?
Oh, minuscule to invisible, I would say. Maybe I am being falsely modest about it. I'm of course, rather pleased. Although I don't know what it means, I'm pleased nonetheless. I'm much more interested in meeting the deadline on my book than having new little things to put on my resume. But I hope my mother doesn't spend the $15.
Writer Pat Monahan and station manager Kit Jensen on what it means or doesn't mean to be selected as an Outstanding Young Woman of Alaska. For them, primarily, it seems to mean a thrill for their moms and a $15 book bill. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Fairbanks's municipal election of October 2nd isn't over yet. We've already had one runoff election, that was October 23rd, and now there'll be a recount of that election. The runoff for a borough assembly seat between Kevin Herron, the incumbent, and Andy Carella, who had left his own assembly seat to challenge Herron, initially showed Carella winning by 151 votes. However, when the more than 600 questioned and absentee ballots were counted, Herron emerged the victor by a margin of 56 votes, 0.9%. As expected, Corella, who had taken out a series of controversial ads against his opponent during the campaign, asked for a recount at the borough assembly meeting Thursday night, the first meeting since the runoff election. Herron, an assembly member, stated that he would abstain from voting on motions concerning the recount, but did state,
"If there is any doubt in mind that perhaps it may be a good thing to recount, I personally didn't find anything wrong at all, but I know Andy has made an effort to come before us tonight and see whether, in fact, it was held. And I personally, though I won't vote on it, would state that I have no objections if there is a doubt in mind."
The borough has no procedure for conducting recounts. It hasn't been done before. After debating the appropriateness of applying state procedures for election recounts, which were deemed inappropriate, the assembly voted 8-0, with Herron abstaining, to initiate the recounting of the ballots. That should be completed before the end of the week, at which time, more than 5 weeks past the election, the seesaw should stop sawing long enough to see just who is the holder of borough assembly seat A. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.